dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. And there is no more articulate champion of the free world at the moment than our first guest. He is Ambassador John Bolton, formerly the permanent U.S. representative to the United Nations, the man who set the gold standard, in my judgment, for that job. He formerly also served in a number of other capacities, including that of Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. He is currently a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute and the author of simply countless important essays in all the right places, I might add, as well as Surrender is Not an Option, his best-selling book of his time at the UN and elsewhere. John Bolton, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be with you.
We're talking with you at a moment when warnings that you, among others, have issued over the years about the dangers associated with the Obama administration's, fecklessness and irresolution and hollowing out of our military and so on, now seem to be coming home to roost, as it were. Let's start, if we could, John, with your take on the closure of missions of the United States from Mauritania to Bangladesh, I believe, that appears to be now going to be the norm for some time to come.
Well, the breadth of these embassy and consulate closures is unprecedented in my memory. And I've racked my memory to see if we've ever done anything like this, and I don't think we have. And I think what it shows is how vulnerable we are across this very dangerous region. I think it's almost certainly the prudent thing to do to close these posts because of the threat. We're not playing checkers here. People's lives are at stake. But the conclusion should be not what this particular closure means, but what 5 years of the Obama administration have meant for America's place in the Middle East and North Africa. And I think it's clear that not only is al-Qaeda not on the run, as the president told us all last year and even before, it's growing in strength. It looks like a different kind of an organization, but all organizations evolve, including this one. And we have been asleep at the switch. And the best or the worst example of that is Benghazi from last September the 11th, where our ambassador and three other Americans were killed. Here we are almost 11 months since that assassination attack, and we have done nothing, underline nothing, to retaliate against the perpetrators of that attack, to destroy their capabilities to do it again, or even to arrest them under the Obama administration's criminal law view of terrorism. We have done nothing. What does that tell al-Qaeda leaders? What does that tell radicals in the Islamic world? It tells them that you can attack and kill Americans with impunity. And I think this is part of the consequence we're seeing right now.
And it only invites more of it. In fact, as you know, John Bolton, there is exactly one person who has been effectively prosecuted and incarcerated in connection with the Benghazi event, and that was the poor fellow who made a video that evidently had nothing to do with it, but nonetheless is being put into hard time again. John, this is indeed evidently a response in part to the Benghazi experience. We're seeing sheltering in place on a global basis, as Richard Fernandez puts it. Our friend Mark Stein described it in a terrific piece at the National Review Online corner today by talking about the cringing superpower. You're a serious practitioner of national security policy with lots of years, both, as I say, in service in your country's various agencies, but also as an observer. What comes of this kind of cringing? Is it likely to be a sort of sustained lockdown of our missions and our people in the face of an emboldened adversary?
Well, I think that's the only direction that you can foresee, given the policies that we're pursuing. Look, the president and his close advisors have a worldview that says America is part of the problem. In fact, we may be a major part of the problem. Our strength, our success, our presence, our assertiveness provokes other people. And they attack us because of what we do. So under that theory, since we're the problem, the world would be a safer place if only America were less assertive, less visible, less powerful, less successful. And that's certainly the road that Obama's tried to put us on. It just so happens that that view of America's place in the world is 180 degrees the opposite of reality. It's not, as they say, American strength that's provocative. It's American weakness that's provocative. So the notion that if we cringe in place, we will be safer is completely the reverse of the truth. This will simply provoke more attacks, more threats, more danger.
Yeah. As our former boss, Ronald Reagan, used to say, we don't get into wars because we're too strong. John, let me ask you about a related matter. You've written at the New York Post about the Muslim Brotherhood agenda. And I must tell you, I welcome this piece by you tremendously, because I personally think much of what is going on here, frankly, is, as you say, a disconnect between our sort of submissive behavior on the one hand and our failure to understand what is animating not just Al-Qaeda, but these Islamists more generally, including Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about how you see things playing out in Egypt at the moment and what the United States policy, in your judgment, ought to be towards the new government there and towards the Muslim Brotherhood, which it seems to think ought to be reinstalled in some fashion.
Yeah, I think we should support the interim government in Egypt, which is backed by the military. I think we have to recognize the Muslim Brotherhood for what it is. As it is now, it is not fit to participate in a democratic society. It is not democratic. I use the language of Supreme Court Justice Jackson when he talked about the Communist Party, describing it in America 50 years ago as a state within a state. Now, the Brotherhood and the party are obviously very different in many, many respects, but that characterization that the Brotherhood has its own agenda, it is not democratic internally. It doesn't engage in election campaigns to foster democracy in Egypt, but to gain power, which it never intends to relinquish. So when you treat the Brotherhood as just another political party, you're fundamentally playing their anti-democratic game. And I think the Obama administration and many on the Republican side, too, just don't understand that. So I would outlaw the Brotherhood. If that's what the interim government decided to do in Egypt, I think we should support them. I think that's the only practical thing that the U.S. can do to safeguard what our key interests are there, that Egypt continue to uphold the Camp David peace agreement with Israel, and that there's enough stability in the country that the vital Suez Canal remains open.
Two critically important strategic objectives for us, for sure. You know, I'm minded that we ought to be doing the same here, John Bolton. We've got the Muslim Brotherhood operating inside, among other places, the Obama administration, I fear, and that's in part because they're not being treated as the enemy that they are. Some have called it communism with a god, what these guys are about. I'm not sure that there's that much difference between the party and them, other than there is this a divine mandate as they see it. And I guess the question that occurs is, if we don't do this, aren't we really playing into the Brotherhood's ambitions to simply supplant this government again at the earliest opportunity? And that would seem to me to be very much in prospect.
Well, that's why these arguments that the military and the interim government should get back on a path as soon as they can to have more elections is like the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different result. The Brotherhood won the first set of elections because it was the best organized political force in Egypt. And as of today, other than the military, it's still the best organized force in Egypt. So if you just run the elections again, you're going to get a carbon copy of the last one.
Right. In addition to being organized and disciplined, it's the most ruthless. John, we have less than a minute. Quickly, is the reset with Russia in a shambles? And what should President Obama be doing in the wake of the Snowden decision by Vladimir Putin?
Well, it was a mistake to press the reset button to begin with. It has been in a shambles, and this decision by the Russians to grant even temporary asylum to Snowden, I think, demonstrates that beyond any argument. Now, what is Obama's response? To deny the possibility of a bilateral meeting with Vladimir Putin when he goes to Moscow next month for a G20 summit. That's all he can think of, to deny Putin his august presence. You know, Putin can care less about
it. He may not even do that as a practical
matter. So, I mean, look, Russia needs to feel real pain for what they've done, as does China for letting Snowden get out of Hong Kong to Moscow. There's no evidence the administration has taken any strong steps against either China or Russia. That, too, will simply embolden them and others of our adversaries. They think they can push us around, and we don't do anything in response.
Yeah, a formula for disaster. John Bolton, as always, thank you for joining us. We look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. Will the United States cede to China a forward base in the Atlantic? That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert at Secure Freedom Radio on matters involving Asia and much more. But he is also a tremendously valued contributor to such outlets as Forbes.com, where he is a columnist, World Affairs Journal, a contributor, and also, of course, to Fox News. And Gordon, we have been tracking for some time the rising aggressiveness of communist China. But there's a new turn in this drama and its relationship with the United States. And I want to visit with you a little bit about it. There's an island called Tesoro in the Azores and a base there by the name of Lejes. Tell us what's going on that may have potentially quite significant strategic implications for the United States and be a new front in the Chinese aggressive behavior.
The United States Air Force and some other units as well is in Lejes Field, which is in Tesoro in the Azores. It's a 10,000-foot runway, and from there, we can control the Atlantic. Now, the Chinese want to be in Tesoro. The Pentagon wants to turn what is now an Air Force base into a ghost field, and that's really important because the Chinese have been sniffing around the Azores, and they've made it clear to Lisbon that they would like to base their planes there. Now, the Portuguese, a NATO ally, don't want to do this, but they may have no choice because the base is an important part of the economy, the Azores, which is already depressed. And so we're leaving an opening for the Chinese to make a very strategic gambit into the North Atlantic.
Gordon, very quickly, what is a ghost base?
A ghost base is where we have very few personnel. Right now, the Pentagon wants to slash force levels there for the Air Force and for the Navy. This is really important because the House, fortunately, has blocked those staff reductions. This would devastate the economy there, and so clearly the Portuguese are very concerned.
Creating a vacuum of power that would be filled by the Chinese, almost certainly. Gordon Chang is our guest. He is the duty expert for us on matters involving Asia, and we're talking about this base that the Pentagon thinks somehow it can retain on the cheap. But Gordon, if it is so important for the economy of Portugal and the Azores most especially, there will be a powerful temptation to cede it to the Chinese. What might the implications of that be for both U.S. interests in that very important part of the world and for China's ability to project power throughout?
Well, Frank, from Lejes Field, the Chinese could patrol the North Atlantic and therefore potentially disrupt aircraft and shipping. Also, they may be able to shut off the mouth of the Mediterranean, which is nearby. And Lejes is about 2,300 miles from New York and Washington, and that puts the U.S. into play. So clearly, this is important for us.
It's so important that it seems unimaginable that we would let this happen, Gordon. And yet, is it your sense that the moment that we are looking at budget-driven decisions that will effectively make it inevitable?
This is clearly budget-driven. The Pentagon is facing the sequester, and therefore it's looking for places that it can reduce personnel. Lejes is a prime target. The House, as I mentioned, is trying to block this, but now it's up to the Senate as they look at the defense appropriations bill. So this is going to be a self-inflicted wound, because if the Chinese are in Lejes, that means that we have to build up our force levels in the Atlantic to protect ourselves. And so this is not going to be smart budget cutting.
It's the old penny stupid and pound insane. Gordon, let me turn to another topic that I know you're following closely that may have bearing on Chinese behavior as well. You have been chronicling the unraveling, really, I think is the only way to describe it, of the Chinese economy. You have a piece at Forbes on the 4th that talks about the last stampede, capital now exiting China. Talk about that, and in the context particularly of what you think it portends for the Chinese economy more broadly.
In June, we started to see the first signs of capital flight from China. those signs were not big, but they are momentous in the sense that they are a turning point. Because in the beginning part of this year, we saw a lot of money, speculative inflows into China to take advantage of certain economic trends and certainly the strengthening of the renminbi, the Chinese currency. But because of the liquidity crisis in June, and also because of the problems that first started to surface in May, investors are now starting to change their mind and are taking their money out of China. I think that this is one of the first signs of an impending failure of the Chinese economy, because money is really important indicator of people's intentions.
It is a leading indicator, though. How far away from much more widespread problems and perhaps collapse do you think China would be, given that we're at the early stages of this this capital flight?
It's not impossible to see a failure of the Chinese economy this year. Beijing will do all that it can to postpone this. But as Beijing postpones it by pouring more money into the economy, they just make the ultimate problem bigger, and they make it impossible to solve, because the new money is going into the especially risky projects, which cannot be paid back. And so, therefore, there's creating even more of a debt buildup. And this really is the central problem for China, is the increasing amount of debt, which is perhaps 200, maybe 210% of gross domestic product. That's well over the warning sign of 60%, and certainly worse than ours, which is 105%. And ours is horrible. China's even worse.
Gordon, to the extent, we've visited with you frequently about this question, but to the extent that something along the lines of what you've described is in fact in prospect, and certainly would be very much on the minds of the Chinese leadership, they would know even better than we what's now looming. Do you anticipate that you're seeing a growing likelihood that they will try to lash out externally in order to try to either stabilize their situation at home or at least bring in additional resources that might be the spoils of war?
This is more than just a possibility. You know, we have seen Beijing's especially aggressive behavior this year, and it starts from India, where we've seen these incursions starting in April, or the big incursions starting in April. There have been other smaller ones. And we've seen the problems with Japan and the Philippines this year worse than we've seen in the past. And clearly, as the economy deteriorates and as the mentality of Chinese leaders must be changing, I think that there is a direct connection between China's more aggressive external behavior and what's happening inside the Chinese economy. So we need to be especially prepared, because a weak China could be a lot more dangerous than a strong one.
Yeah. And one of the other facets of this that, again, we visit about from time to time, but I'm just interested in any update you might have on it, Gordon Chang, and that is sort of the demographic dimensions of this Chinese meltdown, if I may use that expression, particularly the size of its young male population, for which there are no women. Another impetus, it would seem to me, for this kind of external aggressor.
China right now is going through some very adverse demographic patterns. They're accelerating even. The workforce is already declining. That occurred in 2010, according to China's leading demographers, or 2012, according to China's official National Bureau of Statistics. That's well before the 2016 that was projected just a few years ago. And the entire population is going to shrink sometime before 2020. And we have a lot of excess males in China, as you pointed out. This has caused so many problems inside Chinese society, including the violence that we have been witnessing over the last several months. This is a problem for Chinese leaders. There is the bare branches theory that many people think that the increasing number of males is related to in not only internal problems, but external aggressiveness. This is one factor pushing China in the wrong direction.
Mark me down as one of those that is concerned about this, as I think you are, Gordon Chang. As always, thank you very much for joining us. Gordon, once again, is a contributor of great moment to the national security debate and awareness of what's happening in Asia, and most especially with respect to China, the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Forbes.com columnist. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again next week, and we'll look forward to talking with you then. Next up, David Satter joins us to talk about U.S.-Russian relations in the aftermath of the Snowden asylum decision. Straight ahead.
to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. American embassies are closed in Muslim nations from Mauritania to Bangladesh in light of threats from a still quite dangerous Al-Qaeda. Other Islamists are waging or threatening civil wars to impose their totalitarian Sharia doctrine. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin contemptuously rejected Barack Obama's request not to give asylum to NSA turncoat Edward Snowden. And Communist China is projecting growing military power to control the strategic South and East China Seas. Such are the predictable consequences of the Obama doctrine of diminishing our country, emboldening our enemies, and undermining our friends. For too long, we have foolishly indulged in hollowing out our military, losing wars, and otherwise signaling weakness and irresolution. We had best return to the Reagan strategy of peace through strength before we have too little strength to secure our peace. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by David Satter. He is one of the country's leading authorities on Russia and what its past has been and what its present is about and what its future portends. He is currently a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, my alma mater. He is also an advisor to Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, and the author of numerous important works, including most recently, It Was a Long Time Ago, and It Never Happened Anyway, Russia and the Communist Past. David Satter, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
You have written an important piece recently at National Review Online and enables us to pick up on a conversation we had earlier in the program with our friend John Bolton about the asylum that Vladimir Putin has now given to Edward Snowden, the NSA turncoat. Tell us what you make, David, of the calculation behind this action. Clearly an offense to the United States and calculated at that, but what do you think is going on with Vladimir Putin as he makes such a calculated affront?
Well, I think there are several factors here. One is the general desire of the Russian leadership to convince the Russian people that there's an external threat and that they are standing up to the West and defending them against the West's aggressive intentions. So anything they do to challenge the West, no matter how seemingly absurd in our eyes, plays into that interpretation. The other factor, I think, here is the desire, really it's simply a gangland response, to try to make it clear to the U.S. that Russia will not tolerate any attempt to enforce international legal standards. It's got to be borne in mind that this comes after the passage of the Magnitsky Act, in which American legislators said that they don't want Russian criminals to travel freely to the United States, invest here, and buy up property and keep their assets here while they're pillaging their own country. Well, the response of the oligarchy that is in charge in Russia is, don't try to impose any rules on us. We can be 100 times uglier than you can be, and we're going to show it. Now, of course, so for both of these reasons, it was entirely logical that Putin would react as he did. And maybe there's even a third reason, which people haven't given attention to, and that is the inevitable blowback from the reset policy. The reset policy was a policy which presumed that the faults in U.S.-Russian relations were the problem of the Bush administration, which did not handle Russia properly. We were going to handle Russia properly, we were going to address their concerns, and as a result, there'd be a new era of cooperation. In fact, Russia's attitude to the U.S. has very little to do with the friendly gestures that are made by the American president. There are other factors at play. But what we did was we set ourselves up. We put ourselves in a situation in which we made it clear to the Russians that we don't understand how to deal with them. We don't understand who they are. And this created a kind of temptation just to show us. And I think that's what's happened.
They have indeed showed us what their behavior is when we behave as we have in an accommodating, if not supine, fashion. David Satter, let me ask you, you've made several key points in this piece entitled What Asylum for Snowden Means at National Review. And let me just go through them because I think each of them are so important. This clearly holding onto Edward Snowden, even as he continues to leak information, notwithstanding Putin's admonition that he mustn't do that to his American partners, as he puts it, makes any kind of damage in assessment of his espionage and his assistance to unfriendly powers much, much more difficult, if not downright problematic. Why would Putin, again, be so interested in impinging upon our ability to understand the magnitude of this this espionage disaster?
You know, it's this is a very special leadership in Russia. We tend to think of the leaders of almost any country as defending their country's interest, even dictators. To some extent, that instinct is justified because there are many dictatorial regimes or authoritarian regimes in which the leader does have some conception of the national interest. What we have in the case of Russia, however, is a regime which couldn't care less about the national interest of Russia, concerned only with its own preservation. And that is a fundamental difference. In fact, from the point of view of national interest, what Russia's doing now is extremely destructive, because we need to find out what it is that Snowden has betrayed in order to do a better fighting world terrorism, which threatens Russia as well as us. So logically, Russia should be willing to cooperate with and anxious to cooperate with the United States. The fact that they aren't reflects the special character of the Russian leadership. Yeah, the fact that you know they're more concerned about their criminal activities and protecting them than they are about protecting the population of their own country.
Well, I guess this is the definition of a kleptocracy. David Satter of the Hudson Institute is our guest, and also an advisor to RLRFE, as it's known, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe. David, the other thing that I wanted to just dwell on for a moment was your observation that Edward Snowden has dressed himself in the mantle of someone who is committed to civil liberties, human rights, the rule of law, and so on, and yet is now in a country in which none of that applies as a practical matter. Talk a little bit about, if you would, the insight that we got into all of this from the Livinenko affair and what it might portend for Edward Snowden himself now that he's thrown himself into the arms of the Russians.
Well, we should first of all look at how Russia deals with people that it deems to be traitors. Edward Snowden was a real traitor in that he took secret information vital to the safety of millions of ordinary Americans and handed it over. First of all, publicized it, in that way revealing it to terrorists, but also handed it over to potentially hostile foreign powers. That's the definition of a traitor. But there are people in Russia who have attempted to expose or oppose genuinely illegal activities, such as assassinations, plots to blow up buildings with the residents inside, and actual terrorist acts. And one such person was Alexander Litvinenko, and the response of the Russian authorities was to poison him with radioactive polonium in an extremely sophisticated and clever plot. Even though he had been living peacefully in London, and in fact had not revealed anything that was both secret and legal, but had spoken only about secret activities which were illegal under Russia's own laws. In any case, Russia exacts draconian revenge.
It did indeed. And it's a message to Edward Snowden. David Satter, I'm afraid we are out of time. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. David Satter of the Hudson Institute and also the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Keep up the great work, my friend, and we'll look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, Robert Springborg joins us to talk about the true intentions of the man who is now running Egypt's transitional government, maybe its next president. Straight ahead.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're
delighted to welcome back Dr. Robert Springborg. He is a professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School, a man with deep knowledge of Egypt, where he lived for a number of years. He is the author of two very important pieces recently, one in Foreign Affairs, the other in Foreign Policy magazine, dealing with the leader, at least for the moment and possibly for the long haul, of Egypt, a man by the name of General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. We're delighted to have you back, Dr. Springborg, to visit about what al-Sisi is up to and what his proclivities might be.
Thank you very much, Frank.
We have spoken in the past about something that you tumbled upon in the master's thesis, I guess it is, of al-Sisi when he was a student at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Remind us of what you discovered in that document that suggests his inclinations may be a little different than we're led to believe as he is currently cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, it's in fact not a master's thesis. He didn't get a master's there. It's at the end of a short course, they write a mini thesis. The paper is entitled Democracy in the Middle East, but in fact what it is an explanation of how democracy and Islam might be made compatible. And from the perspective of an Islamist, it would essentially amount to democracy being instrumental for the implementation of Islam, so that Islam would come to be the dominant consideration of the various branches of government, and the ultimate purpose of Islam would be the reestablishment of what amounted to the period of Muhammad and his immediate successors. And this is a sort of a long-held-out goal of Islamist thinking that goes back and has started to be articulated in Egypt around the turn of the 19th, 20th century. So it's a classical sort of defense of Islam and how it is a modernist view of life, and that Egypt and indeed the world would be better off were it to be more devoutly Muslim. But I will emphasize that he puts this very much within an Egyptian national framework, and there he differs from the brothers, because the brothers are internationalists in the sense that they see the application of Islam to be not bordered by countries, whereas for Sisi, his Egyptian nationalism comes first, and then the Islam rides atop that.
Hmm. Explain that a little bit further, if you would, Dr. Springborg, because I think for most of us, the notion that an Islamist is an Islamist is an Islamist is rather indifferent to these sort of national boundaries or nation states. Is there really a practical distinction to be made between someone who considers himself an Islamist but an Egyptian nationalist first? Or is it simply that Egypt should be the seat of the caliphate in the future, not Turkey, not Iran, not Saudi Arabia?
Well, you're absolutely right to point to the certain ambiguity that lies there, but before we come to the ambiguity, to back up to the whether it's a transnational or a national view, what General al-Sisi has done is essentially accuse the brothers of treason. And they've been treasonous because they have elevated their associations with other Islamist movements, most notably Hamas, but also by implication those in Syria and elsewhere, above their loyalties to Egypt. And so he has indicted them on those grounds, and he has by no means renounced Islamism. What he has said is that it's Islamism within one country, that we as good Muslims need to be first and foremost loyal to Egypt, and any Muslim who is not is essentially a traitor. So he has drawn a sharp distinction between his view, which is a nationalist view, and the view of the brothers. So there's a certain chauvinist element in there. Now, as far as the caliphate is concerned, this is a mini thesis, so he doesn't go in great detail to it. And so, in a sense, given his overall nationalist view, what you read into this is that indeed, if the caliphate were to be reestablished, it would be appropriate for it to be in Egypt. And indeed, there was exactly such a move of this going back under the monarchy, first under King Fuad, subsequently under King Farouk, that when the when the caliphate was abolished in Turkey, once Ataturk had come to power there after World War I, then it was sort of a role floating around the Middle East, and Egypt made a play for it. In the event, it didn't occur. But so this is a subject that has a history to it.
Yeah. Our guest again is Dr. Robert Springborg. He is a professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School and the author, among other works, of Globalization and the Politics of Development in the Middle East. And Dr. Springborg, let me just drill down on this one more time, because the Muslim Brotherhood was, as you know, established in Egypt in 1928. And my impression was that Hassan al-Banna, the founder, basically was on board with the idea that the caliphate would be reestablished, Sharia law would be imposed globally, but that it would emanate from the Brotherhood's home in Egypt. Is there, I guess what I'm really trying to get at, is there really that much of a difference between the Brothers and al-Sisi, and do you expect him to really go the distance in terms of prosecuting them and otherwise trying to bring them to heel?
Of course, words and action are two different things, and so it would remain to be seen what General Al-Sisi would do were he firmly in the saddle, as it were. What the brothers did suggested that they were seeking in some measure to implement their transnationalist view, the engagement with Syria, with Iran, the connection to Qatar, and so on. They were really reaching out, and then, of course, they were accused of fomenting sedition in the UAE. So the brothers were very internationalist in the 12 months they were in their power. I doubt very much that Sisi, certainly in the first period in power, would be such, and even subsequently. He's a military man. And military men think in national terms, not globalist, intellectual, ideological terms. So I don't think he'd be, as it were, the spitting image of the Brotherhood, but in uniform. I think there would be a significant difference between the two. And while he would want to project Egyptian power, it would be only partially within an Islamist framework. It would be more in a sort of a standard nationalist framework.
Yeah, interesting. Dr. Springborg, do you think that the Brotherhood miscalculated in expecting, when they promoted him to become the chief of the general staff, as I recall, that he would be more faithful to the Islamist impulses that you have identified, rather than the nationalist and therefore in opposition to them?
Yeah, very much. I mean, it's the accounts have come in now from a variety of eyewitness observers of the conversations between the brothers and the military, and most notably between President Morsi and then Minister of Defense and still Minister of Defense, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And it was as if they were on completely different wavelengths, that Morsi simply wasn't hearing what was being said to him. And this is sort of emblematic of the tin ear that the brothers had to all forces around them. In Morsi's case, he had assumed that because he had dealt with Sisi and he knew Sisi to be a devout Muslim, that he sort of assumed that they were on the same page and that Sisi had truly subordinated himself and the military to the brothers. And he failed to appreciate that from the military's perspective, it was a power-sharing agreement, and that there were certain rules to that power-sharing that the Brotherhood, and most notably Morsi, were continually violating.
We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, Dr. Springborg. Very quickly, one-word answer, if you could. Do you expect al-Sisi to run for president?
Yes, I do.
You do. Okay. We'll be following this closely, as I know you will be talking with you, I hope, in the near future, Dr. Springborg, and to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.